It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week, Pennsylvania's Secretary of Health declared an outbreak of hepatitis A in the state with 171 cases in 36 counties, the hardest hit, Allegheny and Philadelphia. Meanwhile, the county continues to deal with a measles outbreak. Dr. Graham Snyder is Medical Director for Infection Prevention and Hospital Epidemiology at UPMC. Welcome to the Confluence, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the program.
Let's start briefly with this week's news, that declaration of an outbreak of hepatitis A. How concerning is that?
Well, it's good that the public health colleagues are being proactive about it. Hepatitis A is, in the United States, is relatively rare. It's something that we more commonly see in developing countries. And the reason why is that hepatitis A is a hygiene issue. Hepatitis A is the virus itself comes out in our stool, mm-hmm. and it can contaminate food or surfaces that we can then contaminate the food that we eat or right. ingest in some way. And so countries that have great hygiene, both manage their sewage and manage their food and water supply, typically have very little problem with hepatitis A. So in the U.S., we tend to see problems in a few communities of people. First of all, travelers. When you're traveling to a country where hepatitis A is endemic, it's good to be prepared. And we'll talk about preparedness hopefully right. in a second. Mm-hmm. In the United States, though, it's people who are suffering from homelessness or housing instability, people who abuse intravenous drugs. That's one community right. where we see it transmitted. And among men who have sex with men. Those are some of the populations where we see hepatitis A transmission happening.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, has the public gotten maybe complacent about certain diseases? Oh, that's somewhere else in another country, but it's not my problem. Ebola, for example, it's over there. Or we've taken care of that. Measles, for example, and we've heard now that we haven't really taken care of that. So have we gotten a little bit complacent about the diseases, the public, in a sense?
Well, I'm not sure those involved in public health have gotten complacent about it. And we're seeing the reemergence of some infections like measles. And we will always see new threats like Ebola. One of the things about infection prevention and infectious diseases is that we have job security in the sense that there will always be something new. It was SARS, right. MERS-CoV, Ebola, and even the diseases that were once endemic to the U.S. and have been eliminated, like measles, right. still have a threat of coming back because they're present in the world. So I'm not sure I would say that we're complacent about it.
I mean the non-professional, not your like yourself and your medical professionals in public health.
But there are so many important things for our health, infection and non-infection right. related. It can be hard as a lay person, somebody who's not medically trained, to gauge how important all of this should be in our everyday life. So, for example, every season we prepare for influenza. Influenza should be on everybody's mind as we get to late summer, thinking about getting ready to get the vaccine, thinking about prepared in case you're sick. Staying out of school and work. And that should be on everybody's mind every year. Should the public be worried about Ebola every day? Well, it's a threat that's out there. Mm-hmm. We're paying attention to it. From a medical center standpoint, for the hospitals in the United States, we're getting prepared in case it were to come here, but it's a rare event. It's a rare event. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that it's something that should be causing angst and worry in everybody's mind every day.
So since you brought up influenza, that's the regular. I mean, that's the annual recurring flu season. Mm-hmm. So there is preparation for that, the particular vaccine to inoculate us, to prepare ourselves. Are there other steps to prepare ourselves for that flu season, though?
The machinery of public health is a wonderful, wonderful, amazing thing. To me, it's a miracle of science that we can take disease that's happening in a totally different hemisphere, predict what the vaccine would take, to prepare us against the strains that will be circulating this year, because it's not an endemic of one virus. It's actually it's a multitude of viruses. Mm-hmm. There's several strains at any time circulating. So the vaccine is huge. One day, hopefully, we'll have a universal flu vaccine, a vaccine that covers all flu strains, And maybe that's not too far off in the future. But in the meantime, the vaccine is one of our number one ways of being prepared. Once we get into the season, it's all about preventing it from transmitting. And I recommend people do the basics, what we call respiratory etiquette. And this is, if you're going to cough or sneeze, cover your cough or sneeze. Hand hygiene is always important. And staying home from work or school, if you're sick, right, to prevent transmitting. So once we're in the season, that's what's important. The last thing to mention is treatment. We do have an effective antiviral for it, several antivirals, but one that's pretty inexpensive and not much in the way of side effects. That's oseltamivir or Tamiflu.
Right.
And for some people, treatments are appropriate. So as we get into flu season, I think a good message for people is, if you think you're sick with the flu, talk to your primary care doctor. It may be appropriate to get tested and treated promptly.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin, and we're talking about preventing the spread of pathogens with Dr. Graham Snyder, an infectious disease expert at UPMC. We briefly mentioned measles. The number of cases continue to rise nationwide. I think we're up to about 880, according to the CDC, a 25-year high. But it appears that it's not spreading to more states. The last number I saw was 24 states. Is that a victory? Is that just maybe normal fade out of the spreading of a disease? Or is it evidence that maybe some prevention containment protocols have been working?
Yeah, the fact that we eliminated measles from the U.S., and what that means is it's no longer circulating within the United States. All of the cases that we see come from somebody who visited another country, acquired measles there, brought it back, and then it transmitted. That itself is a success of public health. And the fact that we only have 800 cases, although it's concerning to us from a public health perspective, the fact that our public health system is set up that we can contain it to 800 cases is in itself a success. Measles is one of the most contagious viruses that we know. One person with measles, on average, can infect another 12 or 18 people. And so it can be hard to contain. The other reason it's hard to contain is that it's passed through the air. And so if I had measles, and I'm here in the studio, sorry, if I had measles, I'm here in the studio, the virus can hang around in the studio air for another 2 hours. And so, and I could actually transmit the virus before I even have the characteristic rash of measles. So the fact that it's so contagious and it can be so hard to contain the virus from spreading person to person, and then we only have 800 to 900 cases when we have a lot of people coming into the country with measles, that's a success to me.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple of minutes left. Are there different best practices for hospitals for different bugs?
Yeah, so we do a lot of preparations for all sorts of infections in the hospital and all healthcare settings. Every healthcare facility will have an infection prevention team that's ready to prevent transmission of bugs and identify it when they happen. One of the essential issues that we're dealing with is that we are not sterile things. People are covered in bacteria. And so whether that be a Staphylococcus aureus, staph, or measles, or something really sinister like Ebola, the first thing we pay attention to is how it's transmitted. Is this something that goes from person to person by contact? Is it in the air? Is it something that is in the air just for a brief period of time? And so the protocols that we have in place help build barriers based on that transmission pattern. There are a couple things that are always good to do. Respiratory etiquette's important.
Right.
Hand hygiene is super important because that prevents transmission of lots and lots of stuff. So we're always emphasizing those measures.
Briefly, what about partnerships? You're talking about inside the hospital, but what about partnerships outside with colleagues in public health and other organizations?
I sing the praise for our public health colleagues, both the Allegheny County Health Department and the state and other health departments in the region, because we have a great partnership with them. We work very closely in communicating about transmissible infections, for example, recently measles,
right,
communications about hepatitis A, and that's important. We also have communications from not just the inpatient hospital setting, but with our community partners, private practices, with the long-term care facilities and nursing homes that we work with, and in between different hospital settings as well, different hospitals. Those are critically important to understanding and preventing transmission.
In our last minute or so, I want to ask you, what scares you? What threat might be out there that scares you?
Well, in one sense, I'm not scared because I know we can prepare for anything.
Okay.
On the other hand, I'm scared because there's going to be something that we don't know yet. There is some disease X out there that we don't know about yet. And maybe it's maybe it has a high risk of death like Ebola, or maybe it has a high potential to spread like flu. And so what scares me is the possibility that there's something else that we don't know yet that we'll have to figure out quickly and prepare for quickly. That's a real challenge. I think we'll be ready for, because that's what we've been doing. But that's the thing that I would say I'm always looking out for.
Dr. Graham Snyder is Medical Director for Infection Prevention and Hospital Epidemiology for UPMC. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on the program.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin, and we're joined post-primary election day by politics editor Chris Potter. Welcome back to the program, Chris.
Good to be here this morning, Kevin.
So, if you've been listening all morning, you know that City Council incumbents Deb Gross, Ricky Burgess, and Corey O'Connor all sailed to victory, and Bobby Wilson pulled an upset in the North Side, prevailing over longtime Rep. Darlene Harris. Chris, it's just the tip of the ice, city iceberg, I should say. What were your takeaways?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's the top line story, that Bobby Wilson beat Darlene Harris, who has been sort of a thorn in the side for Bill Peduto, the mayor, for many years. She's a constant no vote on council. On one hand, Wilson's victory probably won't change much in terms of how the city is governed. Darlene was never able to oppose that agenda successfully. I think council meetings will be shorter now, which is a blessing for many of us who have to cover them from time to time. But I don't think it'll change anything about the legislative priorities of that body. I think the bigger story here is kind of outside the city, and it involves a couple of races at the county level, particularly the Democratic at-large county council race. It's not a race a lot of people pay attention to in the real world, but I can tell you, I was at an Eaton Park late last night, and there was a Democratic office holder who was stunned by that result. This is Bethany Hallam, a first-time candidate running against John DeFazio, who has been a county councilman for 20 years. He's like one of the first.
He's the original.
He is. He was part of the original, the OGs of the of county council. Bethany Hallam beat him. This is kind of the continuation of a trend that we've seen last year with victories by Summer Lee and Sarah Inamorato, the year before, victories by Mick Pappas and Anita Prizio, another a county council person. These are progressive young female candidates beating entrenched Democrats with a grassroots progressive base that is fired up right now.
So are traditional Democrats worried, or should they be worried?
Yeah, I've been talking to some folks, and they are taking notice of this, because what it really says is you can no longer, as a Democrat, kind of count on a victory. I think a lot of these races that I just mentioned have had in common is they're against longstanding incumbents who kind of got used to the idea of winning. These were often races that didn't attract a lot of attention, so a small motivated base can kind of punch above its weight, and that's what's happened. And the other thing that's happening too is there is a network of sort of support for these candidates emerging. A political community named Unite, backed by Summer Lee and some others. There are campaign professionals now who are starting to work on these campaigns and really starting to get a feel for how to win races in this county. It's a big deal.
Speaking of county, what about the DA's race? No big surprise. So Stephen Zappala has held that office for 20 years. He's got another four. For some reason, a Republican gets in and upsets him in November.
Which is possible, although not likely. There have been at least one or two write-in efforts on the Republican side that took place yesterday. We won't know for a couple weeks whether those work. They have to kind of count up those ballots to see who got the most votes and if they got over the 500 minimum. So we'll see how that plays out. But on the Democratic side, you're right. Steve Zappala beat Teron Jenkins, who is challenging him, by about 20 points, so 60-40. Even there, though, you got to remember that the Jenkins campaign was not particularly active. He kind of stepped on a landmine right out of the gate last summer when he made some ill-advised remarks about LGBT folks right. That really hurt him. He never kind of recovered from that. He never did TV ads, and yet he kind of posted what a lot of people thought was a closer finish, even though it was 20 points, than they thought that they'd be seeing.
So did his message resonate at least somewhat?
Yeah.
And I mean, will that get maybe Stephen Zappala to change a few things.
I think Stephen Zappala would tell you, look, a lot of the things that Taron Jenkins was asking me to do, I've already done when it comes to sort of, you know, opposing the use of cash bail or diversionary programs. So we get people help that they need instead of putting them in jail when they have substance problems or behavioral health issues. So I don't know about that, but I do think a lot of Democrats, and they told me this last night, even people who had nothing to fear from the polls, that a lot of them are sort of cognizant that this constituency, this county is changing. There's these millennials are coming up. They're engaged. They're fired up. And a lot of these sort of older super voters who've dominated politics for a while are either moving away or passing away. And that is changing how these folks are going to have to campaign going forward.
Do we know much yet about the new nominees for the courts?
I personally have not been following those judicial races terribly, so we don't. I know that Mary McGinley was the endorsed Democrat. I think everybody knew that she was going to win the common pleas race here. Statewide, we'll see. I know that probably the most conservative Republican running for Superior Court, Rebecca Warren, did not win, and that would have been a very interesting race. She's associated with a fairly controversial case involving the use of abortion medications that really created a national stir.
This was, of course, just the primary,
yeah.
Still a full election to come in November. What are you going to be covering as we get closer to that time?
I think one of the things I'm going to be looking at in the short term is what I said, kind of this, where does this movement go now? People thought, this is just when Summer Lee wins or Sarah Normato wins. It's just their district. Somebody couldn't win a race like that countywide. And now that's happened. So kind of all bets are off. I'm also interested, too, to see kind of where Republicans go here. I think there may be some talk about the fact that Republicans really didn't have anybody on the ballot in some of these key countywide races. They may get some people on by write-ins, but they didn't have them on there. And it'll be interesting to see how Republicans kind of proceed going forward.
Chris Potter is WESA's editor for government and accountability. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Dr. Samuel John Hazo is named Pennsylvania's first and only official poet laureate in 1993. Hazo is a Pittsburgh native and founded the International Poetry Forum, which brought in writers from around the world from 1966 to 2009. He was named the state's poet by Governor Ed Rendell. He's a distinguished professor of English emeritus at Duquesne University, where he taught for 43 years. His published works include Thank a Bored Angel, Jots Before Sleep, and the poetry book As They Sail. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Mayor Bill Peduto announced this week that he was delaying enforcement of the city's new gun control ordinances, which were scheduled to go in effect in June. I went to his office yesterday afternoon. Mayor Bill Peduto, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin.
Last month on this program, you said you wanted a court challenge. So why not enforce the laws to sort of trigger those court challenges?
Well, the court challenges will begin. We believe that by having a stay on the actual implementation of the plan, it will provide us with the fastest ability within the court system to have a judge hear this case. We believe that there have been several previous attempts at local ordinances that have failed, but that our ordinance is different than those from Erie or from Philadelphia. And we believe that once we've been able to make our case, that we have a very good opportunity to succeed.
So was this the plan all along, that you expected sort of a legal challenge as soon as you put your signature on that document?
Yes and no. We didn't know what people would do. We assumed that there would be a legal challenge, but there was no way of guaranteeing that. But once there was, the question before the law department was whether or not to put a stay on the implementation of the bill or to pursue it and then potentially entangle that into the court case. We felt that the clearest way and the most expeditious way was to put a stay on the legislation and let the bill itself go through the court system.
Jonathan Goldstein, an attorney involved in the NRA's suit against the city, he told one of my colleagues that your decision proves the laws are not enforceable. Quote, it's an illegal set of ordinances. They know they can't be enforced. They know they don't have the authority to do it. End quote. Your response?
Well, that's his opinion, but this has more to do with having the ability to have this case heard. From the very beginning, we said that this was going to be decided by the court of law. That there are challenges that we believe should be made to the existing state law, and that within the existing state law, there are areas that local regulations can be enforced without necessarily breaking that law.
So this is not a backing down from your position?
No. I mean, our position is based upon the legislation itself. And that legislation was vetted through about 4 months of procedure that involved attorneys that helped us to draft the final ordinance. And again, from the beginning, have said that this will need to be interpreted by the courts.
That interpretation could take some time, even longer than the drafting of the ordinances themselves. What is your level of confidence of that these laws will ever be enforced?
I don't think that it will take very long for the initial court decision. However, I'd be surprised if there wasn't an appeal from that decision on either side. And that then will be the delay. But I do believe that the delay will not be that great, that the courts hearing this will be given testimony that should be able to make a decision and an interpretation of what is permissible by a local government.
And your level of confidence about whether these laws will ever be enforced?
Well, there's a series of laws that we're looking at. The one is the preemption law that the state has placed on the city. The second is the limits of that preemption law. And the third is the idea that elected officials can be held to criminal charges for passing legislation that challenges laws. So on all three of those, I think there's different levels of confidence. I wouldn't put my percentages out there, just as the NRA probably won't put their percentages. But if we didn't feel that it was, number one, necessary, and number two, that we had a chance, we wouldn't have passed the bills.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking with Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto. Earlier this month, anonymous hackers breached through the City of Baltimore servers. The online components of running the City of Baltimore basically are on hold, such as government emails, payments to city departments. They can't be made online, and real estate transactions cannot be processed. The hijackers have demanded a ransom. The city says no. So, Mayor, how at risk are we? How at risk is the city of Pittsburgh when it comes to cyber hackers?
Yeah, well, not only all governments, but all organizations have a certain amount of risk that they face in cybersecurity. The city of Pittsburgh has been hacked before. When I was a member of council, many city employees had their personal information hacked twice, and PayPal accounts created in Asia, in which their social security number and other information was made available to the hackers. There seems to be a different level of hacking that's going on in government today. The city of Atlanta was recently hit, and it is one in which hackers are demanding payments for the information to be returned, or at least not to be distributed. We're at risk when we realize that. We do work both internally and with other organizations to test different ways of being able to penetrate our system. There's no 100% guarantee. There is always somebody trying to figure out a way in through the back door. And we just try to keep it as secure as possible, but understanding that just like any other organization, that the threat is real.
So is that a regular evaluation of your protocols of the security, or does something like the Baltimore case cause you to say, you know what, let's take yet another look at what we're doing?
Well, internally, we have people that work on this as their full-time job. I mean, whenever you have the amount of information that a city accumulates, you also have a responsibility in order to try to protect that. But on an ongoing basis, we also work with other institutions and have simulations of ways that they try to break in and allow us to know where they're could be a potential fault. That is on an ongoing basis. It's not on a daily basis like our own staff, but it is on a continual basis.
I mentioned a moment or so ago that certain operations within Baltimore sort of on hold. Does the city, without giving them away, of course, but does the city have sort of backup protocols for keeping city operations that are tied to online, to keeping them running?
There is a certain level of redundancy within the city, but unfortunately, because we had in the past done this almost like a silo effect, department by department, it isn't standardized. There are additional precautions that we take with public safety information that allow it to operate differently than, say, the planning department. But at that same time, there isn't a standardized way of being able to say across all information in the city, there is an equal level of redundancy.
I think you said can't be 100% secure, but how confident are you?
I'm confident that we have a system that is adequate. We have been investing over the past several years on a modernization plan. We had brought Deloitte in to be able to look at all of our IT and to be able to present us with a plan that would basically adopt the needed changes over the next, I believe, 5 or 7 years. But we're dealing with hackers that are much more technical than what we are able to keep up with. So I worry about it. I think as anybody should who has information that is public information, but I also have confidence in the team that we have both internally and those that we're working with externally as well.
I wanted to ask you about Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman's listening tour about recreational marijuana. He finished it up this past weekend in Philadelphia. The prior weekend, he was here in Pittsburgh. Mayor, you've led the way to decriminalize, and you supported decriminalizing possession of small amounts of recreational marijuana in the city. What about legalizing marijuana? Should it be legalized?
I believe that not only should it be, but that it will be. And I think that's something that will happen across the country as well. The abilities of medicinal marijuana have been proven. They have been able to help people who suffer from pain, from people who live with depression and anxiety, and there is a medicinal benefit of cannabis. At the same time, the recreational use of it is basically no different than that of alcohol. And if you look for who the major opponents of the legalization of cannabis are, they're coming from the tobacco and the alcohol industries. Just like any other substance that provides a high, there has to be responsibility, and that responsibility falls to the individual. But I don't believe that marijuana is something that people should be prohibited from. I do believe that if done responsibly, it has the same negative impacts as liquor.
Do you support it because you think it's the right thing to do, the legalization, or that it could be a good economic revenue generator.
Well, I think the revenue generation is a secondary component of it, but it certainly is one that should be recognized. There is the potential for hundreds of millions, if not billions, of new revenue into the state, and that would have to be an issue that was decided where those funds would go along with the decision to legalize marijuana.
You said, do you believe it will be? Obviously a future tense. How far in the future? I mean, you have a Republican-dominated legislature, and as you well know, it took quite a while for medical marijuana to get legalized in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, but if you also look at the legalization of medical marijuana, you don't hear an outroar against it. In fact, it's almost universal in the support of it. I believe that Pennsylvania probably will be later to the show than the states that are presently considering it. But within the next 5 years, I can't see where there will be many states in the country that haven't taken the path towards legalization.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Memorial Day weekend marks the unofficial beginning of summer. It also marks the opening of a small, nostalgic amusement park just south of Lake Erie. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Kovash reports this 127-year-old tourist attraction is finding its identity in modern times.
It all started about 5 years ago. The original devil that was in there, he was paper mache.
On a recent Saturday, Tom Broadfoot works on a ride called the Devil's Den at Conneaut Lake Park.
His face was crumbling and he looked really terrible. Well, I decided that I was going to redo the devil.
It's a dark, winding, haunted house-style ride. After swapping out the deteriorating papier-mâché devil for a more menacing, lifelike mannequin, he was hooked.
I just kind of took it on as a project. You know, it's my way of giving back to the park.
There's a lot of Broadfoot in the Devil's Den. He made a swamp alien, a vampire, and a Medusa. He and his wife recorded their own voices to bring to life the ghosts of Edgar and his bride, Elizabeth. The Devil's Den is a 50-year-old gravity-fed pretzel ride, named for the way it twists and turns. Broadfoot says rides like these used to be all over the place, at amusement parks and traveling fairs. Now, the Devil's Den is one of the only pretzel rides that remain in operation. But compared to other rides at the park, the Devil's Den isn't even that old, says Lenny Adams, who's the maintenance supervisor for the park.
Tumblebug's almost 100 years old. The Blue Streak is over 80. Carousel's probably in its hundreds.
Conneaut Lake Park first opened in 1892 as Exposition Park. And after more than a century, it's a little rough around the edges. If you look closely, you can see old wood, chipping paint, and cracked cement. In fact, it was the perfect setting for the 2009 post-apocalyptic movie, The Road, which was partially filmed there.
A lot of our rides here at the park are old. We have a lot of classic rides at the park. It's basically, we're a working museum.
The park has changed hands a number of times over the years. In 2007, it closed after the owners at the time accrued years of debt. Adams fixed up the Blue Streak roller coaster when the park reopened in 2009. But still, the park was a shadow of its former self.
About 10 years ago, when you'd come and half the rides would be shut down.
Debts followed, and in 2014, Conneaut Lake Park filed for bankruptcy. That's when the Economic Progress Alliance of Crawford County took over management. Executive Director Jim Becker says since then, the park has made headway financially. While it's still in bankruptcy, it's cut its debts in half and should be out of bankruptcy in the next several years. In many ways, it's thriving. The rides are all operational again, and it reopened its water park a few summers ago. It also employs about 70 to 80 people in the summer, and ticket sales continue to grow. It brought in about $40,000 in ticket sales in 2017 and more than $60,000 last year.
But it's a process that we are not professional amusement park operators, that's for sure. We take this on as a almost an additional responsibility as a community asset.
From family vacations to company picnics, it's a place that's full of memories for Western Pennsylvanians, says Angela Annabelle with the Economic Progress Alliance.
I think it's the nostalgia. I think it's hard to find a place like Conneaut Lake Park, an amusement park. It's not a big, crazy amusement park. You're not going to find the steel wood roller coasters, but there's a lot of nostalgia there, and it's a cool story.
There are also few other places where you can still ride all day for just $10. I'm Sarah Kovash, 90.5 WESA News.
And Sarah's hopped off the carousel there to join us in studio. Sarah, welcome to the Confluence.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
All right. So if you want the fastest, the steepest coasters or rides that sort of flip you upside down a lot of times, you're probably not going to go to Conneaut. But there are some rides that might help us recall our childhood visits to amusement parks there, aren't there?
Sure, yeah. There's a lot of old nostalgic rides there. One of which is the Tumblebug.
Tumblebug. What's that like if we're not familiar with it?
It's the same ride as the Turtle at Kennywood.
Oh, okay.
And the one at Conneaut Lake Park is 100 years old, as I mentioned there. But yeah, it's, you know, the Tumblebug and the Turtle are two of the last rides of their kind left. They were created originally by Traver Engineering Company, which is located in Beaver Falls, and they're kind of relics of a older time.
Oh my goodness. Is that because other parks just say get rid of the old, come up with something newer, faster, steeper?
I think that's probably part of the case, yeah.
Okay. So you told us it's similar to the Turtle. I mentioned coasters just a moment ago. Conneaut has an American Coaster Enthusiast Historic Landmark. So what is special about the Blue Streak?
Well, the Blue Streak for Conneaut is kind of their main attraction. It's the biggest ride. It's going to be the fastest thing you're going to ride there. And it's just kind of, you know, one of your classic wooden roller coasters. Doesn't have any fancy loops. There's a big drop at the beginning and you kind of just, you know, go around after that. But yeah, it was one of the first coasters to be designated as a historic landmark, not only because it's one of the last of its kind, but it also operates in the traditional manner, too.
And having talked to some folks from the coaster enthusiasts, they truly are enthusiastic. So putting their stamp of approval on there is something for this ride.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that Conneaut is definitely proud of.
And it's how old?
It's 80 years old.
It's 80 years old, okay. And I do, I confess, I prefer the wooden coasters over the steel coasters myself.
I do too.
Conneaut, you alluded to it briefly in your story. It has had its financial troubles over the years. Are they pulling out of it yet? And is there a future for Conneaut?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a future for Conneaut. They're, you know, definitely on the upswing. They did file for bankruptcy about 5 years ago, but in that time, they've, you know, taken their amount of debt from $3 million to just over $1 million, which is amazing, especially in such a short period of time. You know, they've sold off some property near the lakefront to kind of help do that. And then, you know, in addition to that, they're also becoming more and more profitable each year. They're selling more wristbands for the rides. They're getting more people to, you know, come to the marina and camp at their nearby camperland too.
In our minute that we have left, one of the people that you talked to in your story that we just heard referred to Conneaut as like a community asset. They didn't talk about it as being a business, this big operation that's run. There's a dedicated group of people that really want this to survive, to keep memories going.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in addition to, you know, people in our area and people north of the city who grew up going there and have fond memories, there's people like this woman, Sandra, who I didn't actually get to include in my on-air story. But she, you know, she goes, she drives up from Grove City and spends 4 days a week up there volunteering, you know, digging up garden beds and cleaning rooms at the Hotel Conneaut.
Why?
Because she loves it. She grew up there. She told me she remembers going to Kittyland as a kid when she would go for her father's company picnic every year. And it just has a really special place in her heart. She told me, you know, this place just grabs some people.
And apparently it grabs a lot of people.
Yeah, it definitely does.
Sarah Kovash is WESA's digital engagement editor. Thanks so much for coming by, Sarah.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, international law enforcement partners led by U.S. Attorney Scott Brady have taken down a large malware conspiracy network. Brady will discuss improved international cooperation in going after cyber criminals. Plus, the numbers are in, and is Pittsburgh's population growing, holding steady, shrinking? If you missed anything from today's program, or if you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich and Julia Maruka. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.